Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Buy premium Irish dry-aged beef at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And we have a cracking show today. We've got Michelin star chef Keelan Higgs of Variety Jones. Brilliant chef, good guy, real open. And they've had some mad bad luck there with his new restaurant going on fire. He's had a great career. He's been
there. He cooked for us at the Eurotalk Young Chef dinner there a couple of weeks ago. He did the main course.
He did the main course for the Young Chef of the Year.
He's a fabulous cook.
Yeah, he's highly regarded in our industry. Really looking forward to having the chats with him. We'll have our culinary conundrums as always, and we'll throw in a wee recipe of the week too. Don't go anywhere.
Okay, Gary, so for our recipe of the week this week, in the steak box, you actually get some footlong sausages, and I think you had something nice that you'd like to do with them.
We chili dog, maybe.
Oh, yeah, man.
You ever have one of them?
Do you know, I've seen them. It's basically chili con carne across the top of a footlong.
Yeah, it can be, yeah.
Yeah, right, come on,
it's
yeah.
Different, I suppose, yeah, that's what I do. I'm going to barbecue the dog as well. Like, I mean, it's a sausage as opposed to like an American style hot dog. Like, so just cook your sausage as you would on the grill, have it cooked, set aside, but real quick with the chili. Have you ever come across the chili beans? Like Bachelors have them and Heinz have them. They're in a can, just wherever you
already
see,
spiced.
Wherever you see like tins of beans and tins of chickpeas and stuff like that, kidney beans so get two or three, depending on how much you're making. Like, so say we'll make like a kilo of mince or whatever, get 200-400 gram, usually about 400 gram tins of chili beans, and it's literally, you know, kidney beans, black beans, maybe cannellini beans or whatever else. There's three or four or five different kinds of beans just in almost like a chili con carne type sauce. They're just already done and they're brilliant, mate, you know, saves a load of time or whatever. So then cast iron pot, really, really hot, in with an 80 or in with a 90-10, like a 90% beef, 10% fat. You'll see lots of different chops. You spoke about that last week, I think, on the show. Make sure there's a wee bit of fat in the mince. Fry off, caramelize the mince. Once the mince goes in, start breaking it down with a wooden spatula or a wooden spoon as quick as you can. And really, really hot pot, salt, white pepper, get it really, really dark. And then once it's all colored, pour off your excess fat and then add in about one large Spanish onion chopped up fine enough, in with an onion, and then maybe two or three stalks of celery peeled and diced up fine, in with that, one red, one green, one yellow pepper, and add that to your caramelized mince until it softens up a wee bit. Then, you know, the wee jars of paprika, or smoked paprika, sprinkle in about 2 tablespoons of smoked paprika. Dust that around the mince. In with another wee bit of white pepper. Let that sort of cook, and you'll start to smell that now kind of coming up. Then put in two level teaspoons of dried red chili flakes. Add that in. Give it a good mix, and then in with 2 400-gram tins of chopped tomatoes, and then in with 2 small tins of your bean mix. The chili, it's going to be called chili beans. In with your chili beans, and then maybe about 200 or 300 mils of passata. In with that. Bring it to the boil and then turn it down to like a fairly decent sort of a plop or whatever it'll be. Give it a wee bit of a taste at that stage. Adjust the seasoning. Let that plop away for about 50 minutes on the stove. And then whenever you go and check the consistency. If you want to get a wee bit more richness, then put in about almost a half of a tube of a tomato paste. Like, lots of recipes call for like a wee teaspoon of this and that. You always need way more tomato puree than you think you need.
It helps thicken the sauce, Gary.
Yeah, yeah, it really thickens the sauce. It just adds a real, real strong depth of flavor. And now at that, you should have a lovely, decent flavored bean chili, bean and beef chili, and as I say, like a nice little bit of residual heat whenever you're eating it. So then go to a soft Italian bread roll, like a soft roll.
You're a fan of a soft roll, aren't you?
A soft roll, yeah. Give it a wee bit of a lick of some mustard, a tiny, tiny bit of ketchup. You're going to have enough sauce anyway. Then add on your Johnstone sausage or your bratwurst, the big sausage that comes in the box, on with that. And then spoon on or ladle on a decent little row all the way top to bottom of your bean and beef chili. And then a nice fine, if you can get that blend of mozzarella and cheddar blend over the top of it, let it melt into it, and giddy up, there's your little chili dog.
Cracker.
Have at it. Okay, so joining us now on Dishing It Out is Michelin star chef Keelan Higgs of Variety Jones. Keelan, nice to have you in with us, mate.
Well,
you're very welcome.
Happy to be here.
Fresh from cooking a course, I believe, at the Young Chef of the Year last week. How did that go down? Big dog sitting at the table out there.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, it was incredible. And what was really beautiful about it was that you cooked in your style. Not that it was ever going to be any other question. I know someone said to me, "Oh, you doing a share of main course?" I was like, "Oh, I didn't do a share of main course." I rang you and I was going to ask you to cook beef, because normally what happens is I find out what ingredients we've used from previous years. And then it was actually very refreshing when I rang you. You were like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to do the pork dish. I'm going to do it with plenty of mushrooms. Yeah, I'm going to do it." So, and I was like, "Grant.
Heaven.
Perfect. What way are you doing it?" "Oh, I'll do it the way we do it. It'll be sharing." Wonderful. Perfect. I didn't even have to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have been so inclined to do it if someone was telling me what to cook. What works for us in the restaurant, that I know how practical it is, and practicality in cooking and in my place is always a very important part of it. You know, if you can get it out for 10 people and it looks great, fair enough. If you can't get it out for 150, well, then it's not worth doing, you know. It's kind of how I would put it, kind of down and dirty. I've been at that dinner before and you get great food, but it's usually quite delicate and people are trying to impress the people sitting in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to impress anyone. It better taste good. That's all.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Delicious. You're taking the same approach that I took, and I know Gareth definitely took it as well. Like, we've done the REI dinner a few times. I've done the Young Chef of the Year dinner once, Brona. Had you a young chef in the final, or you were just cooking? You don't do it like that anymore.
What used to happen was the young chefs used to do a course with their mentor. But it was really unfair because they were at the competing that morning, and literally the minute it was over, they were hightailing it.
I was in the final twice.
Did you cook?
Twice.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay,
twice.
Okay.
So, well, like, and I mean,
I suppose we're saying it more for the listener. So but a few years ago then, we had the young chefs go back and do the canapé. And even at that, it felt...
It was just another... canapés as a dinner or something.
Yeah, but it was just another thing that they have to do. Yeah. And then a few years ago, we went, you know what? We just reach out to our network of friends and Eurotalk.
That was a good idea.
It was shattered by the end of it anyway. Yeah. I mean, when you're going from the crack of dawn like that, going to the competition, obviously there's a lot of nerves. You're up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're out, you're cooking all day, you're back, you're changing, you're photo shooting, then you're going, getting all your gear down to the event, then you're cooking, then you're waiting for the announcement. So by the end of it, it's 10:30.
And just let's give the listener a little bit of a background, Keelan, of how did you get into cooking? What did the first few years look like?
I suppose I tell this to a lot of the customers that I deal with in the restaurant, but my dad kind of ran restaurants when I was a kid and is a very good cook, so I was always around it as a kid. I can remember, like, earliest memories just standing beside the stove.
Was he a chef?
He wasn't a chef, he's just always interested in cooking. I mean, like, if he was cooking at home, we had very little, fuck all, I would say, apart from food in the house, so there was always that kind of notion of the family dinner was a huge thing in our lives. So it was 6 o'clock, the table was loaded with grub and everyone dug in together, and he'd always cook for 20 people as opposed to the 7 of us.
Yeah.
So guests were invited and stuff like that, and you never know who would drop in, but there was always loads of food. So I was always around it, always had an interest then. and he kind of told me never to be a chef for some reason, you know, the rail filler tells you not to do something, you end up doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's initially how I got into it. I got my first job then at like 13 in a local golf club that was dishes, and then you're doing starters and desserts, which is, it's a great introduction. I mean, you definitely learn how to move your arse. It mightn't be the standard that you end up working at, but I mean, it gives you a little insight into what's going on. So it always gave me a few quid in the pocket and kind of spurred me to keep going with it. Worked around home, around Greystones where I'm from, till I was about 18 or 19 in local places. Went to college then, did my 4-year degree in culinary arts, DIT. I suppose the kind of, I don't know, eureka moment that probably indicates that you've come some massive discovery that's going to benefit your life. I went to Gibo's in my second year of college for the internship for a few months. And although I was, you know, proficient and fancied myself as a bit of a chef, you kind of get you come back down to ground
pretty quickly when you went in there, I'd say.
Well, yeah, you get the lads that break you down, all right, but you also see what levels food can be at.
Yeah,
and that was kind of a mind-blowing moment for me to see that there is levels to the game.
Mm.
And that kind of set me on the path then. So at that point, it was like...
How long did you do in Gibo's? A couple of months?
Yeah, I mean, I was there a month for a stage, and then after that, I was paid for another 2 or 3 months. And then it was time to go back to college, and it was finishing that was like I just retired. Because it was a long, tough, and very educational few months in there. You know, early starts, 5 splits, dogs abuse. And it gave me the foundations to kind of be the chef that I am today. Like, so I would still always say, like, Ciarán or Guillaume, if I saw them, they still get called chef.
Yeah.
Out of respect, Ciarán, I'll always say, you don't need to call me chef.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need to, but it's a term.
You want the point, chef, or not?
You know?
Yeah, that's easy when you say that point.
In particular, there was a week that coming up towards the end where Ciarán really took the time. A couple of people have left, so I ended up running the cold section. Then I was moving on to the hot section and stuff like that. I'm 21, like... green as they come. I in college, I was always a leg up ahead of everyone because I've been doing it for years. But like at that level, you're very, very green. So Ciarán spent a week with me and just kind of explaining.
Showed you what he wanted.
Explaining how to extract flavor from things. And flavor was always a thing for me. I always kind of had a natural affinity for what goes together. But that week, you know, it stood to me and it still does today.
So, and then you went over to Tuscany.
Yeah, I was in Italy for a while. I'd kind of, in third year of college, you're told to do an international placement. Now, a lot of people go to France, they go to Spain. I think I was the only person going to Italy, and they didn't have any contact. So I kind of reached out to a couple of places, one in particular up in Siena. So that was set up to go over for 3 months. And I want to say it was 2 days before I rang them up just to say, right, I'm getting this flight and I'll be over. And they're, the chef's gone and we're not taking you. So I was like, what are we going to do? So, reached out to the college. I got back to them saying,
thank God you rang them.
As opposed to turning up. Although, I've kind of, like, as the story played out, I was a bit of a spare prick there anyway. But the college got in touch with Ross Lewis up in Chapter 1, and he reached out. He's a friend who I think was a big part of Osteria Lucio, Luciano Tona.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
He's a very nice fella now. Yeah. Not a lick of English. Maybe he has now, but back
then, he still has very little English. No.
Yeah, yeah, and it doesn't bother him.
Yeah, yeah.
So he basically said, "I've nothing for him, but tell him to come over.
Get him going.
We'll find something." So, packed the bags. I went. I landed in Parma Airport, and then I think he collected me from the airport. Brought me out to his house in the country. He was the head of this cooking school over there. I think it's one of the most prestigious over there, called Alma.
Mm.
So he said, listen, you're going to stay with me for about 2 weeks. We'll get you into the college doing a few bits. And this is what I could extract from my limited Italian. So I was out in this country house.
I've actually been to that college a couple of times over now.
Magic.
It's incredible.
Oh, it's absolute magic. Amazing. So everything was in Italian. I had my little Italian dictionary, and I had probably 20 B&H in my pocket. And that was basically...
Way you went.
Yeah, way I went. So I was there for about a week or two. And then he set me up with a stage in a 2-star over in Tuscany, which is, I'm pretty sure it's on the other side, up in the Tuscan Hills. So I went on a mission. He basically dropped me to the train station and said, right, off you go.
This is
where you're going to.
Yeah.
So a couple of hours on the train, I had to stop in Florence. I had massive bags. I brought 40 kilos of bags.
Oh,
there's loaded with cookbooks and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
I need all this stuff. And so I was looking
at needed a chef's
what a jacket, and that was it. And so I arrived in Florence, and it was absolutely torrential rain, and it was also a bank holiday.
Oh, having a nightmare.
But I had to find
having a nightmare.
I had to find a place where I could get an Italian SIM card. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to contact the restaurant. So I was walking. I don't want to say 3 hours. Fucking walking.
Felt like
Felt like a lifetime.
And the streets are all cobbled and
pissing wet.
Yeah, yeah.
Got
Daddy's
SIM card.
Words.
Finally.
Don't be a chef ringing in your fucking ears.
Yeah, what am I doing? Can't communicate. Then I got I got a bus then to Siena. It took me about an hour to find a bus station up to Siena, and then there was this small country bus up to Colli Valdelsa, which is the town where Arnolfo, the restaurant I went to work in, is. And this is like old medieval town. This, when you think everything's cobblestones in Florence, this is cobblestones, but there's lumps of shite left, right, and center. Still got the bags with me. Got to the bus station there, and I literally rang on the phone. I was trying to get a taxi to the restaurant because it was the easiest way to find it. But I could tell them where I was going, but I couldn't tell them where I was.
Oh, right.
Because the Italian wasn't there. They didn't speak English, and my brain was so tired after all the travel that I couldn't communicate at all. Yeah. So I met this Moroccan Italian guy at the bus stop. He sorted me out with a taxi, got me up there, and I arrived, and the bread lady, Elena, was like a proper old Italian mama. She's about, you know, she's big as a house.
And yeah.
Straight away, when my Italian wasn't up, I was just like, she was not happy. She was not keen with me. So she brought me in. It was obviously the middle of the day. So it was their lunch break that everyone was gone. And I just remember on the phone, and it was there in Italian, I could understand. There's this kid here. And I was there, oh yeah, does he speak Italian? I said, no, parlo poco Italian. And I was like, no Italian.
Nada.
Here we go. I could understand that she was just saying,
wasn't happy. Yeah.
So one of the lads came down, dropped me to the house, and you know, the rest is history, I suppose. Beautiful little restaurant, serves us out in the veranda overlooking this sunflower field, and the actual glow of the sunflowers would reflect on the veranda like this picturesque.
I can picture it exactly, because outside the chateau, my bedroom in the Loire Valley, man, like it's wheat or it's sunflowers far as your eyes can see.
Oh, you got married in Siena.
It always used to blow my mind.
Incredible place.
But you know what? You chat there about that week. I mean, I know you were in Gibbs a lot longer than a week, but that 1 week where you say Ciarán zoned in on you and flavor and flavor and flavor. But then you look at that journey there, and I put my own head in Boston. I've put it in Belfast. I put it in Galway, in different places. Like, there's so much character building going on there as well, though. Like, you probably had like a good 10 decent shouts at saying, fuck this, where is the fucking airport? I'm out of here. You know what I mean? But you didn't. Kept on trucking, you know what I mean? It's that kind of stuff that stands to you, you know, without being macho about it, but it's really true. Like, where you just dig deep and just say, you nearly get enjoyment out of the misery. Like, what the fuck am I doing with 40 kilos of stupid books that nobody can read bar me? Uh-huh. They're not going to let me put dishes on this menu anyway. I'm here to learn, yet I brought fucking books from college. And you're probably questioning. I would just start laughing at myself. And, you know, when misery just gets so profound, all you've left to do is fucking laugh and crack on. And then, How did you probably ended up making friends for life then, or did you?
Some of the boys that still be in touch with them.
Yeah.
Like, the lads were sound. They all lived a reasonable distance to where we were living. Our staff apartment was like built into the castle walls.
Right.
So the lads would be there during the working week, and then they'd all go home. Now, it wouldn't be uncommon for one of them to invite me hunting, to start the hunting season, him and his elfla out to their place and crack it up.
Or whatever.
It was funny story. The first day of the hunting season, or the first week, we can only hunt this thing called tortora. It's a migratory bird. It's an African migratory bird. So I'm going, fair enough. So we're up at the crack of dawn. They have the sandwiches packed. The L1's made the sandwiches from their cured ham that they make in the attic. The dad had been out the night before, and he'd made all the hides or whatever, like all these just big massive leaves, little circle that you can go into and shoot. So me and my mate Cheapo go out. It's about 6 in the morning. We start shooting. Well, he's like fucking Rambo there. He's left, right, and center. Birds dropping here and there. So like, obviously it was a slight trepidation about handing this Irish fella.
You're grazing their heads.
So he said, right, well, the brown ones, they're hard to hit. So these white ones that land, you can shoot them because they're quite timid. So fucking straight away, boom, hit one. I used to play a lot of Duck Hunt when I was a kid on the Nintendo. So that's no hassle. So I got about 3 or 4 of them. back to his gaff down at about 12. The old one has the spread and the table, three-course dinner, their local wine, they're made in olive oil, the whole lot, back out, bit more shooting. Got home, cooked up all the birds the next day for us and some of the staff, and then I Googled what it was. Tortra, what is it?
It's a fucking dove. Yeah, it's a dove.
What's it? It's a white one. Nice. Peaceful. Tough as an old boot, but I mean, the shooting was good.
Yeah, yeah.
We did eat them now, in fairness, but I'm shooting a white dove. No wonder they're bloody peace birds. They're very timid. They don't move at all.
And they don't hang them at all, or do you know how? They're just
they basically, because they're shooting all year, they rip the guts out and they freeze them down and then they take it from there. So, I mean, I wouldn't be keen on eating the birds again. Mm. The fact that they were doves, I probably wouldn't be keen on shooting them again. No. But it's experience nonetheless. So we'd do that. And then one of the other mates, Maurizio, he was a bit older and he kind of took me under his wing a bit. And we'd go spearfishing every couple of weeks. So we'd go out, we'd drive for a couple of hours. He had this vintage Cinquecento, proper old school Cinquecento that he loved. He was telling me for ages, I must
beast mode.
Ferrari in
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Brought me out one day to the car park and was looking around everywhere. Where's
little Tonka car in the corner.
Cinquecento, classic thing. So drive out a couple of hours, he'd take the spear gun. I'm garbage at swimming. Like I can swim, but that's about as far as it goes. So you'd see him swimming out. I was kind of spotting with the snorkel. He'd go down fucking James Bond shooting sea bass. You'd see him about 5 meters down into the water, like fucking proper James Bond style. He'd shoot the thing and then he'd, like one hand, he'd be swimming back. So I just remember he got a fish and we'd swum out a bit. I didn't realize how far. So I see him going hell for leather with one arm. He's back on shore. I start swimming away. 2 minutes later, I'm like, Jesus, I'm feeling this.
You're balanced,
here. And I look up and I have moved about a half a meter.
No
and I'm
way.
Like, holy in the bad shit. Place. I could be in trouble here. Yeah. So I start going hell for leather.
Good job, James Bond, was standing on the shore.
Exactly. But I was nearly fucking dead. So there's a rock jutting out of the water. And I'm like, passed out on the fucking rock. This is Italian summer. Like, I think it was probably July or August. Yeah. So everyone's there, like these, you know, Adonis fucking sallows.
You're fucking coughing up a lung.
And I am lying on a rock in the middle of the sea, half dead. So essentially, I got my breath, got back in, hell for leather, and then washed up like a fucking beach whale, belly first,
in a heap
at the shore. All these people with their kids just laughing at me. So,
You made a really swimming there for the field.
You made a really good impression on the Italians.
That's it. And I'm a bit fitter now, but I was like a little fucking barrel. It probably as fuck.
Opened a whole new channel between DAT or Calbrew Street in Italy. Oh, fucking
so then you opened a restaurant then in 2018.
Jesus, that's skipping on a bit. I'd worked around. So like basically I'll make it short because I'm going on.
Well, actually, before you do that, what was your biggest takeaway from the restaurant? Like as a skill set, like I always feel with the Italian food, like I was a much older chef before, like young, egotistical, looking at Italy going, fucking their sauces. But I think as you get older, you really, really appreciate just how beautiful the cuisine is. Like, you know, it's so ingredient led and there's no messing around with it. Like it really just is. When you get good Italian food, it's just unrivaled.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef. Explore delicious recipes and discover their premium selection on johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef, a tradition of Irish dry-aged beef built on 60 years of passion. Learn more at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
And obviously, you know, we'll get to Variety Jones now, but obviously, you know, one of the big hallmarks of your cooking is, like you say, like there's, you know, some chefs just get flavor, and it might seem mad to say, well, surely every chef gets one. Well, they don't, you know what I mean? Some of them think about what it looks like or whatever, but you're sometimes just fucking eating nonsense. Whereas there's a big foundation of flavor in your cooking. Like, is that, you know, come from this time in Italy? Like, did it
enhance? It definitely reinforced
it. It reinforced what you already were.
Like, the chef was arriving at 11 or 12 o'clock every day with a carload of gear straight from the markets.
Right.
There was some of the stuff was a little bit too processed and it wasn't necessarily like old school Italian. He'd do a contemporary menu and he'd do a traditional menu, but the ingredients were second to none and trying to maximize the flavor was something. So all across eating in Italy and the time that I lived there, you can definitely see the love for the ingredients. And that guy, Luciano Tona, before he sent me off, he said, when you're here, this is what I gathered from my limited Italian. Again, you need to eat, sleep and drink Italian. You can't think Irish.
Yeah.
You need to eat and sleep Italian. Think like an Italian. Like, these ingredients are primo ingredients and you need to get involved with them, basically. Yeah. So that stuff always stuck with me. So again, it was reinforcement. Like, I'd grown up eating me and my brothers and sisters, our appreciation for things that taste good. Our standard for what tastes good is pretty high compared to, you know, no offense to anyone, but compared to the frozen pizzas or anything like that some people are eating growing up. You know, we didn't have any of that. We were eating, my dad had spent 10 hours cooking a curry, grind all the spice himself. And 35 years ago is quite unusual for Irish people. Yeah. So yeah, it kind of reinforced all that. Coming off the back of that, I think I started this fresh out of college at 24 into Chapter 1. I was there for a year. I went down to Locks then. I was there for a few years and then I was a sous chef. A star came along. I was head chef for a couple of months. We lost a star. So I got the highs and the devastating lows of that. After 5 years there, I kind of put my heart and soul into it. And kind of not an unusual story, but once they're done with you, you're out the door and doesn't matter what you've done, how many 100-hour weeks or 80-hour weeks you've done, it doesn't matter. Where did I move on to from there? I went to the greenhouse down.
I was
going to
say, I thought you were in the greenhouse for a week.
Yeah. I went down. So the greenhouse would have been there about 5-6 years. And then I went down to Michael in there. And I think the kind of good old days at the start of the greenhouse had kind of passed a little bit, because it was, I remember at the start when you had Kieran Sweeney and Mark Moriarty, and you'd have a team of 8 lads in there and they'd be grafting and they were, you know, steaming and cracking crab claws a la minute for the table. And I think that place and Michael got a little bit jaded by the kind of the star not coming, although you'd probably hate to say it. But when I went down there, we kind of start with 8 people, 6 of them would be stages. And by the end of the week, it'd be me, Michael and a commie left. And then the next week it'd start and you'd start with 7 or 8. And then the same thing would happen over and over again. So most of the time that ended up with me, Michael and the commie, me doing all the cooking, Michael doing all the plating and the commie doing the desserts and snacks at the back. So it was pretty balls to the wall stuff.
Jeez.
But I will say, like, I was only there, I want to say about 8 months, but I will say that it was a very, very creative time. I mean, me and Michael were constantly bouncing ideas off each other. I'd have pages and pages of dishes written out. We'd come in and we'd chop it up and we'd see what we were going to cook. And very creative time and very good for me in general the first few months. And then it starts to get a bit kind of jaded, the long weeks, the lack of future in it, because at that point I've kind of worked for enough people that I knew that I didn't necessarily want to work for someone. So then it kind of came along that an old a friend of mine who worked in Locks with me years ago realized that lease was coming up. They were trying to shift it, and so myself, him and another mate or a mate of his took that on. Relaunched, you know, we got stuck in and I put my heart into it and everything else, and so did a lot of members of my family. That kind of went south then. The dynamic between myself and the other fella in the kitchen, he wanted it one way and I wanted it another way. And it seemed like he didn't want to talk about it. So with little communication, I was kind of, long story short, I got shafted out of there. I turned up and I was told to leave my keys on the desk. And that there was an offer on my shares. I was going on holidays the next day. I said, listen, I'll think about it. You're not going to get an answer today. I'll think about it. I'll get back to you.
When was that?
Jesus, when was that? 2014? Nah, it can't be 10 years ago. Jesus. It might be 10 years ago.
Mm.
Could be 10 years ago now.
Right. How long were you there at that point, Keelan?
I think about six to eight months. So 3 of us went in. Now it was basically...
How soon did your gut tell you that you weren't compatible?
Well, it was... See, we'd work together. We'd live together. We were...
Yeah.
He was one of my best mates, you know. But obviously a lot of work was going in. His wife worked there as well. Oh. So it became evident after a couple of months that there was factions developing, you know. There was a couple of issues that I called to the attention of the other partner, which I was kind of told in no uncertain terms by the wife of the other guy that... she was more his friend than I'm his friend about the partner. I said, well, listen, he's not my friend. He's my business partner. If stuff affects the business, I'm going to tell him. So I felt like there was some kind of stuff going on in the background that
you didn't know about nearly.
Basically, someone was back channeling against me in that place. So like I probably would have had no issue with saying, listen, it's not working. Let's come up with a plan and an extraction plan. And where are we going? Let's talk about it. But they kind of, you know,
Done it for you.
They did it for me. So then my solicitor and myself did something for them. And anyway, we're not friends anymore. I'm out of there. And for the better, for probably all parties.
Yeah, fair in love and war, you know.
It is. Shit happens. And I mean, it's big boy stuff when it's you're talking money and restaurants and companies. And, you know, how you settle it, you get the lawyers involved. And that's how it's settled. Yeah. You can't settle it by chatting. Well, then that's how it goes. So came out of that. It was kind of turned my life upside down then. Because I put, like, when I set my mind to something, I go at it, and I go at it with my
all your beans are in there.
Yeah, so that was kind of, you know, I think it was, it was my 30th birthday. So what is that? 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Because I turned 30 on my holidays, which is 2 days after that happened. But it was devastating, obviously, and then kind of went through all that stuff, and then I had some friends down in Luna, in the heyday, and I just got in touch, I think it was around March, and just said, anything going, you know, just the life's been turned upside down. So I went in part-time just to get me back into the swing of it. And of course, the lads, Carl and Hugh, that were there at the time, just said, come on down. And yeah, I got stuck in.
It was a cool restaurant, one of them around.
Mental,
It was.
It was beautiful.
It was, yeah. But
Declan was running front of the house.
Maxie was running front of the house, like I worked with Declan in Chapter One, so I knew him well anyway.
Yeah.
And always, it's like we always had the crack, so there was no issue there.
Yeah.
It was a mad restaurant. Just seeing the money that they were spending and this place is on a fucking.
But great for you, I suppose.
A timeline here.
This place is not going to last.
Yeah, well, you'd already had a taste of being a business owner, so it doesn't take you long to do the math.
I was always frugal. Like I said, I come from all. So it's never going to be. You're not just going to throw money at everything.
But it was probably lovely to be in a, you know, gloves off, just cook and go to work. And
back to a section. I was back
all
on.
All you were worried about was your station every day.
Yeah, I was back on the open fire grill, and just cooking. I think the lads were quite impressed because they had a decent team there of people, and their menu was mental. There's 15 main courses on, and some of them. One main course is a seafood fucking copper pot. I think there was 12 different elements for that one main course, and you get a table of 10 with 10 different main courses, and that's one of them.
Jesus.
So like, it doesn't matter what you throw on me, it's gonna be up there. Like, I'm just trying to convince the lads. It's probably something similar that I said to Michael in the greenhouse. It's like, man, just sometimes you just have to stop putting things on it and let's just tone it
the
back.
The early years of Mikey's career, he was a lunatic.
Ah, crazy.
He got a fucking 16 steps on a plate. Like,
but he'd do that. He'd change his mind at 4 o'clock, an hour before service. And like, he'd run around all day. And I'm pretty sure at the start, the lads would run around any given time. But like, when three of us are there, it's like, right, I'm boxed off now. It's 4:15. He's like, we just changed this. It's like, listen, there was a plan in place. I've completed that. We got to put another plan in place. Tomorrow morning, we'll go at it, and it's going to be ready for 4 o'clock. But I'm not going to run around like a prick.
Yeah, come on.
So anyway, in Lou and I stepped in straight on the grill. First night, about 60 or 70 people. All these dishes with 10 elements, 5 elements. Anyway, lash it up. It's like, lads, you need to fucking... Are you joking? I'll get it up. But I mean,
But who's working on my day off, you're fucked?
Yeah, exactly. So I think they were quite impressed that I was able to actually pull it off first night without any... you know, because I'd like to think that any chef worth the salt can walk into a kitchen and do a service.
Yeah.
Shite, but you get through it, you know. Yeah. So a good couple of years there, obviously that place started like, you know, a mile high and just declined slowly as the kind of cracks started to develop. But as things developed, people left and it came down to it about two, three years in where there was no, they used to have an executive chef, a head chef, a sous chef, executive pastry chef, a pastry chef. So those people had all gone. And I could see that the place needed. I was always looking for my own thing anyway. So that's the way I said it to them. I said, basically.
And you know, were there that long, Keelan, like 2 or 3 years.
You don't even see it go by.
Yeah, that's
mad. You don't
even
see it go by.
I didn't even know.
I always knew you were in the greenhouse because I would have been probably on the beer with you once or twice. Because me and Mikey would have been tight. And But I was like, Luna, geez, I didn't even know. And now you're saying 2 or 3 years.
But it was the kind of thing where you went in as part-time and then it's okay, I'll agree to go full-time. Okay, I'll agree.
But then if your head was fried, you were probably keeping yourself under the radar too.
But at the whole time, I was looking for the next opportunity. Yeah. So I'd interviewed, like I remember at the time, in between that time, they opened that place, Zosimus, I'd interviewed about because they wanted to make that a franchisable thing. So I went in to talk to them about what they wanted to do there. I did a little cooking thing for Dermot Desmond. Is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
And turns out they were talking about this massive big franchise they wanted to do. And then I showed me the kitchen and it was about the size of this table. And I was like, lads, you can't be franchisable. You couldn't even fit a toilet in here.
Yeah.
So, and then I was in, I remember Glover's Alley was being put together before it was Glover's Alley. So they were interviewing people for that. So I think I was down to probably the last 2 or 3 candidates for that. It wasn't for me. I would have told them as much, but basically with their design and stuff, it's, we wanted to be the chef's restaurant. It's like, well, this doesn't look like my restaurant. Yeah. So anyway, but so there was a lot of things I was trying to do or look for the right thing to do. And then the next thing you know, 2 or 3 years go by, everyone's left. So like I've said, all those people, the executive chef, the sous chef, all this sort of crack. And I said, right, well, you need someone to stabilize what's going on here. You need someone to kind of settle it down and make it a reasonable space for a head chef to come in and really take ownership. So I said, all those positions, I'll do all that. Give us, you know, 1,200 quid a week. I'll do that. No hassle. Yeah. So basically simplified what they did there and steadied the ship. Someone came on board then. And the rest is history. I think 6 months later, the place was gone. Right. I'd like to say that wasn't down to me. I remember the guy that came in, the first thing he was doing was looking to spend a few thousand quid on plates. I was like, ah. I'm after throwing out 500 quid worth of lobster that's been sitting in the freezer for 2 years. You know, buying plates is not on the list here. So, where did I go after Luna? Did I go straight to Variety Jones? I think I did. I think that was, I'd cobbled together from obviously settling that court case, from my 6 months in charge of Luna, and a couple other bits. I copped together about 60 grand.
Yeah.
I applied for a loan from the bank for about 90 grand. They gave me 40. And I did a pre-sale of vouchers for the restaurant that was non-existent. I think I might have raised about 5 grand with that. And then my grandparents gave me 10 grand. So I think all in, I had 110 grand. I took a site on Thompson. You fucking better believe it. 110
good
grand.
Man, fucking hustling.
A shell of a place. So we took this place. It was basically looking for places and you have whatever multitude of architects and bullshitters that'll show you around these places. Oh, I think you could do it for 80 grand. And it's man, this, you wouldn't fucking, you won't even get the toilet fixed for 80 grand in this place. Yeah. It's in bits. So anyway, a friend of mine took a photo of a sign on Thomas Street. This tiny little place, went in. I could see straight away where the kitchen's going to go, where the bar is going to go. And myself and my brother, who was working part-time laboring and looking after his kids, he only had one kid at the time.
So a good warm restaurant was an easy sell.
Well, it was just like the two of us. It's like, I didn't know how to do it. And he didn't necessarily know how to do it. But he's a background and kind of, he's done all sorts of jobs and also the shittest jobs possible. Yeah. But labor and dry line and fucking worked on sites, stuff like that. So he had a rough idea how to go about
that's
it.
What you,
he's a grafter, but the two of us are, you know. So we took it on in September. And our plan was to be open by the 4th of November. And this is a complete gut job. Complete rewire, replumb, and make a restaurant inside 2 months. No one said we could do it, and it turned out we couldn't do it. But I mean, we two of us did about 70-80% of the work, and I mean, we consawed the holes in the ground for the waste pipes, we dry lined it, we painted it, we fucking dug with our bare hands about 20 tons of rubble out of the floor
that, man,
to put in water tanks. I mean, this, what had happened, what we soon realized is that we had a landlord that lived above. She had obviously got the floors dropped years before. So what they did with all the building rubble and all the waste is they just fucked it into the floor and they sealed it in.
Oh no.
There's about 40 or 50 tons of rubble in the basement that was not necessarily part of the lease at the start.
Right.
But was just a dark rat hole full of shite with no lights, no access. So we took a peek and we said, listen, we'll do a job on this and let's go at it. So, and if we hadn't have done it, this restaurant wouldn't be functioning now. So we literally from ground level dug up the floorboards and couldn't get the shovels at it. So it was with our bare hands, 20 tons of rubble with our bare hands.
Handballed it all out?
For the most part, until we could actually get the shovels in, and then we shoveled the rest. And yeah, we put our water tanks, we put our chemical stores, we built the dry stores. So we did about 70% of the work, which nearly killed both of us. So, like,
where did the idea for using fire come from?
Just getting bored. I get bored quick. And obviously been cooking the same way, your same kind of gas stove, solid tops, emulsions, vegetables in. So I wanted something that just kept it interesting. And
because it is something you see a lot more of now, but I mean, I'll say, because maybe it's hard for you to say, but you definitely, well, you were well ahead of the curve here in Ireland.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, there's no two ways about it. Like,
mine still is kind of...
Yeah.
Did Luna have a little bit of a...
They had, they have a grill, so you dump your charcoal in, and it was a, like a metal
Danny
grill.
Over in Loch Ray has, is he in cooking over open fire?
Bingham.
He's all Bingham. Open
Bingham's
fire.
All open fire.
So he took the ball and ran with it there. But I mean, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. So it was like, I drew a picture. I'd seen some stuff in DC. I did a bit of consultancy work over there, some open fire restaurants, and kind of blew my mind some of it. But someone's cooking it over an open fire hearth, which is basically just fire brick, and you burn your logs and you sweep the embers and you cook directly on top. So it was something that piqued my interest. So I drew a very rough sketch to this stonemason that I know, and he got a metal frame built. We got some old bricks from a chimney up in Belfast, and we stuck them in. And then we put a log burner and started burning logs. And I didn't figure it out until we lit it 2 days before we opened. So we didn't know what the fuck we were doing, basically. But just before...
And you were just hoping the smoke would go somewhere?
Well, I knew it was a source of heat.
Yeah.
So... if I have a source of heat, I can cook something.
You can cook something,
I might know what I'm doing, but we can get cooking. So whatever it was, we took that lease at the end of September. We built the place ourselves. We wanted to open in November. That got pushed back a million, you know, a couple of garbage kind of tradesmen that let us down and all the other things, a lot of things going wrong when they should have gone right. Kitchen full of equipment, unset up with a whole
November 4th became what?
November 4th became December 4th. That didn't happen. And still... people were coming in saying this is never going to happen this year, lads. And on the 21st of December, 2018, we opened the doors. 13 people. We were up till 2 in the morning the night before, sticking down because we had to get rid of our carpenter because he just wasn't showing up. We just stories, lads. I should have fucking filmed all this.
I was thinking that.
He decided that half our floor we were going to do, we wanted a kind of parquet floor effect. So he decided he'd get old plywood and he'd hand chamfer each piece to make it
look like it.
And then we would resin the top, myself and Aaron, that is. No idea what the fuck we're doing. but eventually we had to sack him because he just wasn't showing up. So we'd listen, your tools are here. Here's a few quid. We need this done because we can't pay the rent, you know. So 2 o'clock in the morning, we're sticking down. Basically, is all the pieces cut and they're labeled with a letter and a corresponding piece with a number. Now, these have been buried in the basement for God knows how long. So the hatch, we're left like a fucking jigsaw of missing pieces, trying to stick this down, trying to resin it. Oh, and we're opening the restaurant the next day. So eventually we got it done.
Cooking really is the fucking easy bit.
It is. But like, sure, like we're testing dishes and all that. I mean, no chance. We're right up until the last day. So that day, I think I tasted, there was a dish that had always been in my mind. And I bring it back once a year because I really like it. But it's a grilled cauliflower dish with some caramelized yeast. You got a dill and some trout roe. It was always on my mind. I'd never tried it before, but in my mind it worked. Getting everything ready, it was 4:30, first guest coming in at 5, and I managed to get the fire lit. I cooked the cauliflower, I put it up, I tasted it and went, fuck me, that's delicious, we're on here. It's happening. As soon as I tasted it, it works, now we're okay. You know. So that was it. 13 people walked in the door, the absolute shite. I remember the just sticking some stuff on the grill and just like... please cook, trying to blow the embers to get something going. So yeah, that's how we got kicked off.
Wow. And as much of the cooking is happening now, we're still that way now. That's still the way you're cooking.
Essentially, we've developed it a little bit. We've put kind of a framework above the fire with shelves so that we can have things lightly smoking. We can move stuff around, keep like our fish resting and gently.
What year was that? Did you say it was
2018?
Yeah. And how long before you got your star? Was it the following year?
Yeah, I got want to say that the ceremony used to be in October.
Yeah.
So we got an email. Now, we were going hell for leather. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning until midnight every day, Tuesday to Saturday. And then I want to say it was probably July of the next year that we got the email to say you're invited to the Michelin ceremony. Now, me, the gaping wound on my shoulder that I try and not to pretend it's not there, still thinks that I'm going to get stitched up at these things, you know. So it's like, right, I'm either on for a star or it's a fucking public flogging or something. So you just get, we get so many kicks along the way. We're so damaged after the whole construction of the place.
You find it hard to believe. Hard to believe, happening.
Yeah. But as well, I don't, I'm a humble person, you know, so I don't necessarily, like, obviously it was a big deal to me.
Yeah,
because it's the one pat in the back. I don't really give a shite about what critics say or anything like that. Not that I don't respect them, I prefer to concentrate on what I do, and when I feel that it's good, and when the people that work with me feel that it's good, well then it's probably good, you know? So it was lovely pat in the back, and I remember that came in, and it wasn't until I was walking home where you start to think about it and you start taking some deep breaths and go, fuck me, that's...
Did it make a massive difference to the restaurant?
In terms of business, well, we...
In terms of everything, like, as a...
Yeah, well, like, my goal was never, let's get a Michelin star. My goal was to open a restaurant and do the food the way I want to do it, and do play the music I want to play, and have the style of service the way we want to have it, you know? And
But it had no impact?
Oh, it did, for sure. Like, first of all, it's a great pat in the back. Second thing is that it's great for business.
Mm.
It's immense for business. So we got inundated, obviously, with...
People wanted to come and see what's
like
going on.
400 emails straight off the bat looking for bookings and stuff like that. So that was...
Well, it does give a lot of peace of mind, like, knowing that... There's security
in it. For sure. But, I mean, we got... What did we get? November, December, January, February, and then COVID. March was COVID. So we got 4 months out of it. So we couldn't really... Yeah. I mean, I always say that restaurants have a honeymoon period anyway. So the first kind of 6 months that you're open, you're going to get all your business.
The greenhouse and never open again.
Well, there you go. And... your first 6 months go by and then it starts to decline, and then you have to really, you see what you're working with. Then stuff like a star, I'd say it gives you 6 months to a year of a new refreshed honeymoon period. But you're 3-4 months were closed after 3-4 months after getting it, COVID hit, and it's fucking game over. So,
well, we'll move on to a bit of bad luck then that happened.
Wouldn't have any luck at all, mate.
But I'll tell you, and before I get to it, though, like, and it's a real credit to you. Like, I remember reading that great piece in you did in the Irish Times a few months ago. You know, it was like, you know, lost 350 grand. But then, like, you read into the narrative, though, but every paragraph as I went through it, I have to say, like, it was bringing a smile to my face. Going, it goes like, that's somebody that's just got total and absolute belief in the long game, you know what I mean? Like, there was no fucking panic, there was no whatever. We're in the shits, fucking burnt out on opening night. Am I right?
Second week.
Explain the list glasses.
Tell us about the restaurant.
So I mean, just to touch on your saying, the belief, like I always said, and I said to lads when I was in Luna that I was going to open a restaurant there with your own money, because they're all looking for investors. And first of all, I don't need fucking someone to invest 100 grand and think that they own 50% of what I fucking build, because their 100 grand in a year is worth fuck all to me. It's my work and my graft. So they say, with your own money. And I was like, well, if I was ever going to gamble, you know, I'll fucking gamble on myself. I'll take that chance over fucking gambling on anyone else, because I have belief in myself and in what I'm capable of doing, you know, especially capable of doing what I have in my head, you know, I put my mind to it. So I suppose as we developed in Variety Jones, it's a small building. There's no storage. There's fucking, you know, every day is a grind, because it's, you're essentially producing a product that the building is not capable of producing. So the idea was, it's always been grow. Let's get 2 places. Let's get 3 places on the go and start doing some, bringing some serious food across different standards, different ranges to Dublin. So we took the site next door to us. It's an old bank, a beautiful corner building. The idea is to push us, change the kitchen setup, put a wood-fired oven, put a larger hearth, prep kitchen and stuff, to push us to the next level, to raise the ceiling on what we can achieve, because our goal is always to get better. It's not, oh, we're going to get 2 stars, we're going to get 3 stars, something like that. Whether we're capable of that, I have no idea, and I'm not saying that we do. But the goal is always to
get better.
Try getting better. So by new kitchen setup, you're kind of forced to do that. You're forced to change and you're forced to evolve and develop. So that was the initial idea. Obviously, the dining room then would be more versatile and more beautiful, for want of a better word. So it took about 8 months to build. We got 120 grand off the bank and I plowed in, which was actually all our money from the business, which shows that we were doing pretty good. It was about 200-230 grand. Obviously, you do some of it on credit and stuff like that. So it was massive investment for us. Again, we built the first place for 120 grand. There's no fucker in this city or in this country that can build a restaurant from scratch for 120 grand, no. Trust me. And 300 grand isn't even that much these days, you know. Yeah. So we got it done. Beautiful restaurant. Not without its hiccups and all the rest and the usual teething problems when you're building, paying for, designing. We don't bring in interior designers. All this stuff is from myself and my brother's
your
influence
head, yeah.
And what we see and how it comes together organically, what makes sense as well, you know. So after about 9 months, we ended up getting it open. That opened, I want to say July, last week of June 2023, if that makes sense. It was very tough to open. Again, it was completely out of our comfort zone. So we got it open for a week. I got invited to do a gig for Jameson over in London. It was to launch Black Barrel over there. And it was like hashtag Jameson Ignites, hashtag something along those, something fire related. So I went over. I've never missed services. First, the lads were going to cover me for 2 days and I was going to come back. So last thing I said, don't set the place on fire. I went over to the gig with Acme Fire Cult. Acme Fire Cult. Andrew Clark is the chef over there. A legend of a man, but got on really well anyway. He's a good sense of humor, you know. And just before the main course, I looked at my phone and I had about 6 missed calls from my brother Aaron. It's a Thursday night. Aaron's at home with the kids. There's no way he's ringing me unless something's up. So I gave him a call back and he said, I don't mean to alarm you, but there's been a fire at the restaurant. I said, are we fucked? He said, we're not fucked, but it's not good. No one's hurt and everyone's evacuated. It's just like grand. Back in, I said it to Andrew. I said, fucking restaurant's gone on fire, mate. He said, oh shit. You might say it's hashtag touched by fire. I said, you prick. Straight. You have to take it with a sense of humor, you know. Yeah. So then next thing I'm serving a main course to 150 people.
Well,
obviously that was my excuse after the event then to not hang around. I had 2 drinks. I went back to the hotel. I was on an early flight. Yeah. Arrived in Dublin at 10. I was at the restaurant at 10:30. Detritus of a restaurant. Like, you say that like a restaurant goes on fire, you think you have a picture in your head, but you go in, this was a restaurant that had been on fire. Myself, my brother and my uncle, who's he's in property management and stuff, so just there to console us and see what the crack was. So we kind of, a very dark day, straight away, loss adjuster in to try and figure out what's the move. And then it's just like we were scheduled to go on holidays, I think, and we still had 78, which was the old premises. So took 2 weeks holidays and said, fuck this, let's get back in there and start plowing away and we'll let the dust settle here.
Was the plan to close the other one or keep it going?
It was to move Variety Jones into 79, into the bigger premises, and then to do something more casual.
Yes.
Which we were kind of tipping away at. I'd hired a couple of guys and we put the feelers out to do, we were doing a little set menu on a Sunday just to get them into the rhythm and stuff, and obviously the fire wiped.
So the new one was called Variety Jones anyway, or no?
Variety Jones, and then we're going to do Mongoose, which is the casual place. So that's been put on ice, obviously, but
and what had gone on fire, Keelan? Like, what
I don't know how much I can say, but essentially there was a fault in the extraction. The filter seemingly was not appropriate for the levels of heat,
right?
As someone may have mentioned that there was a flash point of something like 75 degrees, and I'm pretty sure the fucking shower is 60 degrees.
Jesus Christ.
So that's what it seems like.
Well, you're still in the middle of it.
Yeah, we're in litigation with our insurance broker.
But you're still running the restaurant, which is the positive.
Plowing away in the restaurant, and recently, so that's been a year. That happened in July 6th, 2023. And this is now a year and a half later. So I just got a pain in my arse. Like I said, I get bored. So I took a little bit of money off the bank while all this is sorting itself out. And we're now, as of 2 weeks ago, in the process of rebuilding. So we're trying to get it back open before Christmas now.
Right.
And plow on with the same thing. So Variety Jones in there, do something a bit more casual in the other space and fucking take it back into our own hands and let's go. Sick of waiting on solicitors, sick of waiting on bullshit. So I don't like things being out of my own control. You know, chefs, they like a problem. Let's meet it head on.
Yeah, fix it and drive on. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's the crack now with that, yeah. So we're plowing on.
Best of luck with that. Like, it's a mad story, but look, hopefully it has a happy.
It shook the food world here, and we were all.
Yeah, we were devastated.
Everyone reached out.
Yeah. And then it was like, I remember, I think Graham Neville sent it to me. He was like, did you see this? I'm like, can't be. That's impossible.
I think I sent a message about it. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, a lot of people reached out. It was pretty.
Oh yeah,
it's very emotional.
Anybody with any decency would have fucking their heart would have broke for you, man.
A lot of people kind of conveyed as much, you know, and it was really appreciated.
Yeah, well, you always know who the good cats are. Like whenever you're staring at down the barrel of a bad one, you know what I mean? Like that. And look, at least the good end of it is you see the best in people, I suppose, that you might not have thought of. But hopefully, you're back up and running. Well, look. We always wrap up with what do we call it, guys? Like death row feed.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like the last thing that you'd ever
your last
want
supper
to eat
if you were getting the guillotine tomorrow morning. What are you stuffing?
I suppose there's a couple of options here. Like we grew up as probably a lot of people did in Ireland with a regular dinner being some variation of minced beef. So chili and bolognese are two of my favorites.
Well, my old doll would give your mammy and daddy a run for their money because I've eaten fucking mince in more ways than any man should.
Yeah. But I think it has to be probably roast beef, Yorkshire puddings, horseradish gravy, roast potatoes. It's hard to beat. The ones you got a decent bit of beef with the Yorkies and the horseradish and the gravy, it's very hard.
I love horseradish.
Yeah, and I'm talking horseradish to the extent where your nose and
can't feel your face.
I don't know what it is. I think it's a chef thing where you just keep shoveling. It's the same with mustard on a sausage sandwich. Plow it on.
It's the only thing you can taste. Yeah, until your fucking one side of your face is numb.
Yeah.
You're raving about wanting really good beef, but you're kind of poisoning yourself with horseradish.
Yeah, there you go, But if I had to choose one, I think that's probably it,
Deadly. Well, listen, thanks very much for joining us, Keelan. And best of luck going forward, mate.
Yeah, I'll eat it, thanks, mate.
Good chat there.
I know, and you know, every time we have a chef in, I kind of be delighted to hear someone that's in the same game as us talking. I mean, he's had a fruitful career.
Yeah, because you always look at Keelan, you know, as being a young, because obviously, you know, we're that wee bit older. Like, but now, I always think whenever you get into your 40s or whatever, like...
I never knew he was cooking in Luna.
Everybody blends into the one age. But when we were in our 20s, he was at school or whatever and we were cooking. And, you know, he was kind of that next wave of young chefs coming. But
he's a brilliant chef.
He was always a really impressive guy anytime I ever met him, you know what I mean? And you can just tell from him too, he doesn't give a fuck about what anyone thinks about him. He's very single-minded, you know what I mean? Very talented, obviously. I loved that story there when he was talking about Italy and that journey. And, you know, I put myself in Boston whenever I went there first and not a penny to my name. It was so easy to go home and all these little twists and turns, you know what I mean? And fair play to him, like, that he stuck it out, you know what I mean? And you can see then when it came to his own restaurant and all the pitfalls of digging up a basement with his brother, money's running out, you're trying to get the doors open, you're doing it all, you've got a landlord who's a bollocks upstairs making your life a misery. You know, every barrier that he came on, it just showed, you know, all the years in with Kieran and Guillaume and Gibos to work with Mikey and the greenhouse. And now opening a business with his brother, then sort of regrouping for a couple of years in Luna. Great story.
Yeah, no, he really is a fabulous chef. So
he's gonna continue to have a fantastic career. Sure. You know what I mean? There's no two ways about it. Yeah, very impressive dude. Really like him, I have to say. Good chat.
So, Ed, have we any culinary conundrums for us this week?
We do, and thanks to everyone for sending them in. Don't forget, food@goaloudnow.com. Hi, Gary and Gareth. Absolutely loving the pod, although I need to stop listening to it before I do the big shop, as you're both costing me a fortune. My daughter has always loved cooking and wants to pursue a career in the kitchen. She is quite hearing impaired, and whilst the aids are great, they can struggle in loud environments. I wanted to ask if her hearing issues will be an issue, and if you've had similar experiences in your career and in your own kitchens with a staff member, and if so, how you dealt with it. Thanks, Geraldine and Claire.
My breakfast chef wears two hearing aids.
Oh.
So, and he can fully hear, but you know, and look, but he has to. I often see him kind of turning around to make sure that he can read people's lip read. But I know his hearing aids give him he can hear with them in. So I don't want to offend anybody. Like, maybe she can't use a hearing aid, but certainly that would be the only thing that, I mean, obviously when the order is called out, you have to be able to hear what's being said. So if she wears a hearing aid, I wouldn't see it being an issue. But yeah.
I've got really poor hearing, you know what I mean? Like, especially in my left side, I don't know what it is. Like, it's shit. But I know what she's saying there is, like, with all the other residual noise, one bit of good news is his kitchens are nowhere near as loud as they used to be. Yeah. Like, 80-90%. And if she's a young girl and she's still a few years away from maybe getting to that career, more than likely, almost every kitchen that she finds herself going to work in is going to be induction. They're going to have refrigerated units that have the motors in a different place. They're usually on the roof where it's cooler. Wow. So you don't have fan noises now in the kitchen
washing
floor.
Washing machines are not as noisy as they used to be. Yeah.
Chefs aren't shouting.
Chefs aren't shouting anywhere at all, or at least they shouldn't be. Shouldn't be working anywhere where that's
happening. They're a much nicer environment.
Yeah. Fans are way, way more efficient now. Like, and like, the motors are not these big, old, noisy things. So as far as like that residual noise that's going on anywhere for her to be able to hear somebody, I'd say she's going to be fine because they're just not as loud as they used to be.
Fantastic, and best of luck. Pass on our best wishes, Geraldine. Next conundrum. Hi, fellas. Your barbecuing and general meat cooking advice has been a godsend to me. I picked up a box from John Stone there last week, and you weren't lying. Absolutely sensational gear, as you might say yourself, Gary. It's a catchphrase now. Here's my conundrum. When grilling steaks, I can never seem to get the inside cooked properly without burning the outside. Can you explain how to manage the grill temperature and whether I should be using direct or indirect heat for a medium rare steak? Love the pod. Keep up the good work. From Sean Travers in Waterford.
I mean, you've kind of nearly answered the question yourself a little bit, Sean. If you're aware of indirect and direct cooking, then you're already half the way there. And for anyone else that's listening, what Sean is talking about is direct cooking is where you cook directly over the flames. So generally speaking, when you're searing off, you cook over the flames part. That gets the caramelization. And then you need to move it into indirect cooking. That's where you're going to move it to the colder part of the grill. Normally, you've heard Gary and I talking about the Komodo Joes or the green eggs. They actually give you a plate. It's like a half a pizza stone that you put over the or underneath where the grill is, and it stops the flames from going. So you'd sear off your tomahawk steak directly over the heat, and then you'd move it over to the other side where the flames can't go up and hit it. And that's where you slow down the cooking. But another little trick that if you're cooking on a barbecue, having a little spray bottle with some water and a little sup of vinegar in it, like an apple cider vinegar. And if everything is getting a little bit too hot, if you just spray the meat, that can slow the it'll bring the temperature down on the bars and on the meat, and that can stop over caramelization. And over caramelization is another word for burning.
Okay.
That can stop it from getting burned. So, or really, if you're out on the grill and you feel like there's enough heat on there, use your oven in your house. Just go in, set the oven to 180 degrees, stick a temperature probe into the center of the steak and finish it cooking. What temperature did you say you wanted to get it? Medium rare
steak.
Yeah, so like 50, if you cook the core temperature of the tomahawk to 48 or 50 degrees and then let it rest, you'll have a perfectly cooked medium rare steak.
Great answer, Gareth. Thanks again, Sean, for sending that in. Final one for this week. Hi, Gary and Gareth and Ed Sheff, of course. Got a shout out, finally. I often get stuck with my weekly meal planning because I don't know how to efficiently use ingredients across multiple meals. What are some specific strategies for reusing ingredients creatively to avoid food waste? Cheers, Leah in Meath.
The freezer really is your friend, Leah, is what I would say. If you bought a little bit too much of one ingredient, a Ziploc bag, and then just, you know, say if you bought too much, I don't know what we're talking about here, but if you bought a bit of mince and you didn't need all of it and you haven't frozen it already, I mean, cook all of it if you can and freeze it that it's made into something. Or, do you know a scene, which chilies is a thing that people tend to buy, and they're normally sold in a pack of four or six or whatever.
That's right, yep.
And you only need one, and then people are like, I mean, from a kitchen point of view, what you might do it is chop it down and put it in some vinegar and some oil and have it as a little vinaigrette, which could be used in a salad. But I know that's not always practical at home. Just throw them into, don't even cut them up, just throw them into a Ziploc bag, into the freezer, and then when you take them out, you can run them on a grater. Gary shared a recipe for a chili, you could throw them in there, or you could add them into, if you're making a curry and you're trying to lift the heat a little bit. So I think maybe that's what she's talking about.
Yeah.
When you move into the other veg that's in your fridge, you know, freezing carrots and all that.
And when it comes to veg and stuff like that, like always just think veg soup or think omelets. Like always, if you're doing a big shop, never shop for every day. Always leave at least 2 days where you don't know. Like, I know it's easy for a chef, right? I mean, I remember Mary, she was the HR manager of a hotel I worked in, and me and Mary lived together. She was a clean freak. So our agreement was, I did all the cooking, she cleaned, you know, whatever, tubing or whatever, we divided out. She just literally hated cooking. She'd open the fridge and she'd be like, there's absolutely nothing in there. And I'd be looking at it going, I see two or three dinners in the fridge. And it ended up being a bit of crack. And she'd open and she goes, well, there's just no way there's a dinner this time. And I'd be like, okay,
challenge,
we'll see.
Let's go.
And there will always be an omelette and there will always be a soup. And there will almost always be a risotto if you've got some arborio. And they're almost, if you have them core things alone, just as a starting point before you even start to get fancy, always say to yourself, have omelette, have soup, have risotto in your mind. Because there's definitely one of the three in there, you know.
Great stuff, Leah. And thanks to everyone who sent in the conundrums. Keep them coming, please. food@goloudnow.com.
Okay, so that's another episode wrapped up, Gary, and we're coming towards the end of the series. I think we've just one more to record after this one.
One more, yeah. We're going to go solo on that one. We might get Ed's box of chocolates out for that, box of questions, as we like to call it, you know? I don't think we've done the box of questions yet. So we might wrap up season 4 that way. We've been renewed for a 5th season, which is brilliant. If everybody keeps listening, pass it on to your buddies, like, subscribe. I know it's annoying and all these people say it, but really and truly, if you're subscribing to the show, it really just shows the boys above that we have an audience. The numbers have been good, but we want it to grow all the time. And we will be back for a new season. We've got loads more good guests lined up. And
And thanks as always for the support this year this season from Johnstone Beef. They've been delighted with the sales of the boxes, and you know we say it every week, but I'm going to say it again. Go head over to their website, get an order in, especially their roast order at this time of year. They really are fantastic. I actually had a rib of beef last weekend. It was delicious. And use the checkout code at
JSBDO.
Thanks, Gary. And look, we'll talk to you next week. And look, Keelan, thanks again for coming in, and best of luck with the restaurant. I know you'll be back bigger and stronger. Your resilience on today's show and the story I really found fascinating. So, all right, thanks a million.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Get premium Irish dry-aged beef delivered to your home at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.